The Rock is 6'4", 260 pounds, a man that will rip your throat out. At your core, you will always be a little boy who will go down in history as The Rock's bitch.
The Undertaker is 20-0 at WrestleMania.
I have a lot of interest in this evening. For one, my brother, Chris. You know, Abyss.
The landscape, the complexion of the WWE has been drastically changed.
From here on out, I do what I do best. Raw ends the same way the last two did, with CM Punk, the WWE Champion, standing tall, clutching his title that belongs to him, that proves that he and he alone is the best wrestler in the world.
Do you know who I am?
I'm Austin Aries. I'm the greatest man that ever lived. Claire Lynch, ladies and gentlemen.
Dixie and AJ are not having an affair. I'm an addict. I've been trying to get clean. I started out drinking and...
I know that you're watching, AJ. And this baby is coming. And I need you to do the right thing, AJ! For our baby! Do the right thing, AJ, for our baby! Do the right thing, AJ!
This is a special edition of the Solemn Monster Sounds Off, episode 253, the year in review for 2012. It is New Year's Eve, Monday, December 31st, 2012. I am the Solemn Monster. I want to thank everybody for your support throughout 2012. For those of you who may have missed it, episode 252 went up yesterday. That was the final regular edition of the Sound Off here for the 2012 year. And this is the second brand new Sound Off of the weekend, so plenty of Sound Off content. Plus, as I mentioned on that show, a couple of vintage episodes of the Sound Off from many years ago have been going up on my YouTube channel. Username on there is The Solemn Monster, all one word. Will be a brand new one, episode number 6 from back in 2007. That'll be going up on New Year's Day, Tuesday, January 1st, so something to look forward to. What we're going to do here on the year-end edition of the Sound Off, we'll talk a little bit about WWE and TNA. Their years in retrospective, 2012, a big year for both companies. There was good, there was bad, there was some stuff in between. We'll talk about that. And also we'll have some predictions, some prognostications, if you will, for 2013. What may be coming up in the new year, things to look forward to, things to expect going forward. It's going to be a fun show. So what we're going to do here is we're going to start off with WWE in just a moment, before we get to TNA. But before we even get to that, I just want to take a moment here to talk a little bit about this show, The Sound Off. We've had a tremendous year in 2012, our best year yet. Picked up a lot of new listeners, a lot of followers on Facebook and Twitter, all that stuff. I've made some new friends. It's been a really great year. That was, I can't say capped off, but certainly when I think back to 2012, for myself personally, for this show, I think back to Miami. I think back to WrestleMania 28 back in March, late March, early April. I had the privilege of traveling down to Miami, Florida for my very first WrestleMania. Now, I've been a fan, a wrestling fan, a WWE fan for as long as I can remember until I was a little tyke. Maybe a little bit older than that. But in all these years and all the WrestleManias that I've seen multiple times, I've never actually attended a WrestleMania in person, and thankfully that streak came to an end this year. I attended my first show. I had a blast. But there were so many different things that we did, myself, Noah Mark, Brian Blade, Webmaster Mike, who deserves a lot of credit for really convincing me to come down to Miami. Were it not for him, I would not have gone. So my thanks to him. And my thanks to Noah and Brian for putting me up and for putting up with me, maybe I should say. We all had a great time. And what really stands out to me are the interviews that we were able to do as part of the WrestleMania experience. We were able to interview a lot of top WWE names. And I've had the privilege of interviewing some really cool people for this show, even though I don't consider my show to be an interview show. What you hear is what you get. It's me talking about wrestling. That's what people like. That's what the Sound Off is. That's what the Sound Off will always be. But over the years, I've had the chance to interview some very interesting personalities, from the ECW Zombie to George Napolitano, who's I'm happy to call a friend and perhaps is the most famous wrestling photographer in history. He's seen it all, literally. To interviewing the former X Division champion in TNA. In fact, the man who I believe is the not the longest reigning, but has the most number of X Division title reigns. I think he's tied with AJ Styles, and that, of course, is Jay Lethal, who is also a former TV champion of Ring of Honor, and perhaps before long may even be the Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion as he heads into battle soon with Kevin Steen. So I had the great honor of being able to do that, but being able to interview John Cena, being able to interview the Heartbreak Kid, Shawn Michaels, Edge, on the eve of his Hall of Fame induction, to be able to interview the then World Heavyweight Champion, Daniel Bryan, who you will never meet a nicer guy than Daniel Bryan. Kofi Kingston, the now, you know, former, spoiler alert, now former Intercontinental Champion as of Raw tonight. Even Kelly Kelly, and I'm not even sure Kelly Kelly's interview made the cut. We had the chance to talk to the Four Horsemen, so many different people. And to me, that will stand out as a highlight for me in 2012. That was Sound Off episode 212, as a matter of fact. We did a live show from Miami with WrestleMania predictions. We spliced in clips of all the interviews. It was a really great time. And I just wanted to mention that right off the bat. That whole experience in Miami, from the interviews we did to the Hall of Fame, my first Wrestle reunion, being able to meet Bobby the Brain Heenan, who's been an idol of mine since I was a little kid, and attending WrestleMania at Sun Life Stadium, and even Raw the next night, which I don't have a category for this. We'll do some awards for WWE and TNA as we go along here, but to me, April 2nd, the night after WrestleMania, that edition of Raw from the American Airlines Arena is the Raw of 2012. Some people may say that it was Raw 1000 in July, and that was a fun show. Although a bit underwhelming, as I recall. I was expecting there to be more cameos. But go back and watch that episode of Raw the night after WrestleMania. From the moment The Rock walked out and the ovation he got, the crowd was just electric all night, everything. Even the CM Punk Mark Henry title match, the fans were going nuts. That was really, to me, I guess it wouldn't be the birth, because, you know, Daniel Bryan had the Yes Chance, I believe, that predated this. But that was the night the Yes Champ became something big. That night in Miami, Daniel Bryan had lost the World Heavyweight title in 18 seconds the night before, and these hardcore wrestling fans who stuck around the next night to attend Raw, and believe you me, this crowd was mostly made up of hardcores, hence the reaction, the lively reaction they had to the show. They were not happy that WWE decided to take the championship off of Daniel Bryan in 18 seconds, and so we paid Daniel Bryan back in kind. We wanted to give him a moment to remember and a moment to be proud of. And I'll never forget that. I mean, literally on Raw, he had one backstage segment. He didn't even wrestle. But he did wrestle as part of the dark match. And the people went nuts. They gave him the honor of actually being the last person out there. They gave him a microphone. He got to cut a promo. That was a very special night. And I attended that show sick. I almost didn't even go to Raw that night. And I'm glad I did, because that was an experience I'll never forget. So the whole weekend, and so again, to me, that was the Raw of 2012. That whole weekend, one of the best, perhaps, of my entire life. That's how much fun I had. And hopefully we could replicate that, or try to, with WrestleMania coming up in 2013 as it comes here to New York and New Jersey. But this has been a banner year for the Sound Off, and I have all of you to thank for it, and hopefully you'll stick around as we get bigger and better going into the new year. So with that out of the way, let's talk a little bit of WWE. I'm not doing rankings or any sort of top 25 list or whatever. I believe I did that last year for episode 199. Just going to talk about some of the key events that have taken place in WWE over the course of the last 12 months with my thoughts. And really, we start with WrestleMania. Rock versus John Cena was the main event of WrestleMania 28 this year. And they billed that match as once in a lifetime. Now, soon enough, they may break that promise. It may be twice in a lifetime if WrestleMania 29 rumors are to be believed. We may be in for a Cena-Rock rematch unless plans have changed. But it was billed as once in a lifetime, and really, no matter what you may think of either man, that was one of the, if not the biggest match the company could have pulled off. Some will say Steve Austin and CM Punk. Perhaps that match will happen one day. But it did not happen this year. And Rock vs. Cena, the seeds were first planted for this 4 years ago. I played audio from an interview that John Cena did with the UK Sun over in London back in 2008. And perhaps the interview was actually taped a little bit earlier. The actual interview may well have taken place in late 07, but it only was used in 08. This would have been during that period that John Cena was out with a torn pec before he made his surprise comeback at the Royal Rumble and won in Madison Square Garden. You know, the audio of the interview was put up on the UK Sun website, and they aired some of the more salacious stuff, which was, of course, John Cena talking about The Rock and dropping an F-bomb and talking about the fact that he just wishes The Rock would come back. Just come back one time and do the eyebrow and get out of town, is what John Cena said. And I remember on Sound Off 17, when I talked about this, I was very irritated by this, and I went on a rant, a vicious rant, against John Cena, which, you know, I still feel the same way that I felt back then, but it, perhaps it was a little unfair of me to rag on John Cena when Vince McMahon really was the puppet pulling the strings. It was Vince McMahon, by all accounts, who sent John Cena out there. At every interview Cena would do, he would bring up The Rock, and he would bring up the fact he wishes The Rock would come back. If there was one guy he could wrestle, it would be The Rock, and The Rock has gone Hollywood, blah, 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 this and that. And that's really where the seeds were planted. You know, I had a chance to actually ask The Rock a question, interview him, for lack of a better word, at the WrestleMania pre-show press conference in Miami just a couple of hours before the pay-per-view. And I asked him that question. I said, you know, where does that hatred for John Cena come from? Because it just felt a little too personal. And he, you know, he answered the question. And basically, he said, you know, it was more just his desire to entertain and to try to give the match some sort of backstory. Instead of just saying, oh, here's two guys, let's have a match, he wanted to, you know, give it a little more emotion and whatever. And I don't know that I completely buy that. You know, I believe that on some level it really did bother The Rock, kind of getting those little jabs over the years. But he came back last year, and they basically spent one whole year building up this main event. And I felt the match itself was good. By no means was it a match of the year. But what will stand out is the fact that this year's WrestleMania, in terms of business done, in terms of money generated from tickets sold, did more business than any WrestleMania. This match did more business than any single match in the history of WWE. And that's a big deal. Say what you want to about what you thought of the match. You know, the buy rate almost broke the record that was set by the Battle of the Billionaires with Donald Trump and Bobby Lashley against Umaga, and Vince McMahon got his head shaved. That was at WrestleMania 23. When the final number settled, WrestleMania 28 came in a little bit underneath that. But they did a very big box office for Rock vs. Cena this year. It was a big match, big-time match, and my first WrestleMania. So it felt special to be there with 65,000 other people in that stadium that night. It definitely had a big match feel. Rock got the win. And now, of course, perhaps it's time for Rock to return the favor to John Cena. If he wins the championship from CM Punk at the Royal Rumble, perhaps we'll have a rematch at WrestleMania 29. But there's no time like the first time. And it was a very big deal. And that, to me, is when I think back to the early part of this year, I know there was the Rumble and the Elimination Chamber and all that. But that, to me, is what really stands out the most. Undertaker also went 20-0 at WrestleMania this year. Nice round number. Beat Triple H for the second time in a row. End of an era. Hell in a Cell match. I'll talk more about that when I get to Match of the Year candidates in just a moment. To be there live to witness an Undertaker entrance is always a special thing. To be there live to witness Undertaker going 20-0 at WrestleMania was a very cool thing. But to me, if there's one moment that stands out above all else at WrestleMania this year, and you know, call me a mark if you want to, but to me, I thought it was an emotional moment, is at the end of that Undertaker-Triple H match. When Undertaker, Shawn Michaels are helping Triple H up the ramp, they're on stage, they turn around, they're arm in arm, and these guys who were just in the midst of a brutal battle, beating the hell out of each other for 25 minutes, they just look out at the crowd. And the place gives them a standing ovation. Everybody in that stadium at that moment was giving them a standing ovation, myself included. It's a great match. It's a great moment. And on some level, it did feel like the end of an era. I'm still not sure what end of an era really means, because Triple H will wrestle again. Undertaker obviously will wrestle again. Shawn Michaels may not wrestle again, but we haven't seen the last of him. I think what they meant by that is, this is the last time you're going to see these three guys doing something together like this on TV. This is the last time you're going to see any combination of these three men in the ring together, locking horns. So in that respect, it felt like the end of an era. A very big moment. And it would have been appropriate for Undertaker to call it quits and just retire at 20-0 and go into the Hall of Fame in the next couple of years and just ride off into the sunset. But apparently, we have not seen the last of the Undertaker. But that was a very, it was a very good match. I don't know that it was Undertaker's best WrestleMania match. In fact, I know it wasn't his best WrestleMania match. That's still 25 with Shawn. But 20-0, big deal. Brock Lesnar also made waves in WWE this year. In fact, 24 hours after that, Brock Lesnar made his first appearance on Raw in 8 years. It had been 8 years since Brock Lesnar had been seen on WWE television. That was at Raw the night after WrestleMania at the American Airlines Arena. I was there that night. Again, I had the honor and privilege of being there. The place exploded. The place would not let John Cena talk during his show-closing interview. They kept chanting, "We want Lesnar. We want Lesnar." The people in that building were smart. They knew that Brock was in the building. They knew Brock was coming back. And when he did, it blew the roof off the American Airlines Arena. And out came Lesnar. And I remember being very excited about this, not just to be there that night, but even talking about it subsequently on the Sound Off, because I had hope that Brock Lesnar's comeback would mean something. It would signify something in WWE. Perhaps it would signify a shift to a more believable kind of version of what is a PG product. You know, those first few promo packages they showed of Brock Lesnar talking about, very UFC-esque, by the way they shot those and put those together. Like you watch many of the UFC countdown specials to hype a big fight. The way they promoted this match with Lesnar and Cena, the way they shot those promo packages was very similar. And they talked about Lesnar, you know, being not a wrestler. He's an ass kicker. John Cena's got piss running down his leg. It was great. Great, great stuff. And it culminated in his first match on pay-per-view against Cena, which I thought was a fabulous match with a not-so-fabulous finish. But the match itself was great. And after that, Brock Lesnar made very sporadic appearances. In fact, I think he made one more appearance on Raw, if I'm not mistaken, and that's when he broke Triple H's arm the first time. And he is on a special deal, is Brock, where he is only committed to a certain number of appearances during the year. And should WWE want to use him for additional appearances, I assume they will have to pay him very well, shall we say. So we haven't seen too much of Brock Lesnar, really, this year on WWE television, which is kind of disappointing. Because I feel like having Brock back, not even for every single show, because you want to keep him special. He doesn't have to be there every single week. But I still feel like he had to be there more than just once every 4 or 5 months to really make a difference. I'm disappointed in that. I had higher expectations for what the return of Brock Lesnar would mean to the WWE product. And in reality, it really hasn't meant anything. Things really haven't changed. You know, they booked the same way. It just feels the same. But when he is around, Brock does give off this aura. He does give off the aura of somebody that could just dismember you. You know, perhaps with one arm. He doesn't even need both arms to do it. He really does feel like a tough guy that you wouldn't want to fuck with. And that's not something, that's not a vibe you get from hardly anybody else on the WWE roster. I don't get that vibe from John Cena. I don't get that vibe from Sheamus, even though Sheamus is a tough guy, I'm sure. But, you know, he's basically booked these days as the, you know, the jolly old number two babyface behind John Cena. But Brock Lesnar's comeback also meant the return of another famous figure from WWE's past, which was Paul Heyman. Paul Heyman, before this year, had not been seen on WWE television since 2006. And maybe it was 2007. I'm pretty sure it was the end of 06. Whenever the December to Dismember pay-per-view was, that was it for Heyman. Him and Vince McMahon had one too many disagreements. Heyman saw the writing on the wall. That was when they had tried relaunching ECW as a brand. They bastardized it. Heyman said, "I'm out of here. I'm done." And last year, Heyman came very close to being back in pro wrestling on the national scene as part of TNA. He was in discussions with Dixie Carter and the folks at Impact Wrestling to possibly come in and essentially take over the product from a creative point of view. And they just could not get over the hump. You know, Heyman wanted certain promises, he wanted certain guarantees that Dixie Carter was not willing to give. Heyman wanted to bring his own people in. Heyman even said in subsequent interviews, he, you know, one of the people he was going to bring in to TNA would have been Gabe Sapolsky, the former head booker of Ring of Honor, now the booker of Evolve Wrestling. And who knows who else Heyman might have brought in as his confidants. Heyman also said that his plan would have been to get rid of all the old guys, keep one veteran on the roster, and it wouldn't have surprised me if that veteran would have been Kurt Angle. I didn't see Heyman keeping, you know, Hogan and Bischoff or Sting or any of those guys. Angle, I think he would have kept. But Heyman had an idea to build around the nucleus of TNA, their young guys, their homegrown guys, bring in other young guys. You know, TNA would look very, very different, most likely, today, had Paul Heyman had come in. And who knows whether that would have been a good thing or a bad thing. I think it would have been a good thing. But the point is, they missed their opportunity. And WWE took advantage of that. They did not bring Heyman in to serve in a creative capacity, which I think is a mistake. I do think that Heyman at least having input into the creative process would be a plus. And who knows? I mean, maybe one day it'll happen, but it hasn't yet. But even just as a TV character, Paul Heyman is fantastic. I think we could all agree on that. He is great in his role. He is excellent. He only came back, really, to be paired off with Brock Lesnar. And what has happened is, because Brock has been off television for so long, and Heyman had a pre-existing relationship with CM Punk, where essentially Heyman was one of the few, if not the only, ally that CM Punk had for quite a while when he was in developmental. Punk was not well-liked. He had his enemies. Paul Heyman always stuck up for him. Paul Heyman is probably the reason that CM Punk is able to call himself CM Punk right now in WWE. He owes a lot of his career to Paul. Paul wanted to work with him, and now they're together. They are probably the best thing going on WWE television. They are one of, if not the most entertaining thing, is the Heyman-Punk combo. And I think WWE is much better off for having Paul Heyman back on television. And quite frankly, I didn't think it was something I would ever see. But there he is. And that's one of the things from 2012 that I'll remember were the returns of Brock Lesnar and Paul Heyman. Fast forward to July. Talked about it a little bit earlier. Raw celebrated 1,000 episodes on July 23rd. They promoted that thing as the biggest Raw of all time. They brought back some old faces for cameos. They had the big DX reunion with Triple H and X-Pac and the New Age Outlaws. Shawn Michaels was there. I believe in that opening segment they actually beat up poor Damian Sandow, who's actually ended up doing pretty well for himself this year. Damian Sandow is one of the shining new characters, the shining new performers that have been promoted to the main roster from developmental. He's done a hell of a job. But Raw 1000 also marked the beginning of a new era in WWE, which is not so good. And that is the beginning of the three-hour era of Monday Night Raw. Raw expanded officially, permanently, to 3 hours on that night, every single week. 3 hours of Raw. It sounds as though it was a call made by USA Network. So I can only blame WWE so much. I really don't think that that's something they truly wanted. But that's what USA wanted. And they got what they wanted. And I don't know if they're having buyer's remorse or what. And I'm going to talk a little bit more about this when I get to the predictions for 2013. Because I don't believe this is going to last. But I think moving Raw, expanding Raw to 3 hours, has had a hugely detrimental effect on the product. WWE is already suffering from overexposure. They have Raw. They now have Main Event, which is a new show that premiered on the ION Network this year. They have SmackDown. They have Saturday Morning Slam, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that. They've got a ton of things on YouTube. They have these YouTube shows now. They're trying to launch a new network. And so they take their flagship show and they move it from 2 hours to 3 hours. And on some weeks, Raw was hard enough to get through at 2 hours. The show now is almost impossible to get through at 3 hours, even on weeks when Raw is good. And that, I think, is where the problem comes in. There is no really positive way to spin 3 hours of wrestling every single Monday night. It's just too much. And most weeks, the show is not that great, which makes it even longer. And Raw ratings have suffered tremendously. Raw has consistently, over the last several weeks, popped some of their lowest ratings in 15 years. I think I'd probably come on the Sound Off no fewer than 3 or 4 times on different weeks and said, well, Raw this week got its lowest rating in 15 years. And then the next week I have to correct myself and say, well, I take that back. Actually, this week, Raw has somehow topped itself and popped the lowest rating that it has popped in 15 years. And you just wonder, how much lower can it go? I think they're in a good position now in that they're heading into WrestleMania season. Football will go away. So every time football goes away, the ratings do increase a little bit. That coupled with them going into their most popular period of the year, I think they'll be okay. But what they have to worry about is what happens after WrestleMania. Because Raw's still going to be 3 hours. And I think that's what they need to worry about. So I don't think this is as permanent a move as they would have you believe. I do think that at some point soon, there will be no more 3 hour Raws, at least not every week. But for the time being, I think that, you know, expanding Raw to 3 hours has had a greatly negative effect on the product. I think it's burning a lot of people out. I think a lot of people don't even watch the show anymore. They watch it exclusively on DVR so they can fast forward through half of it. And these are diehard fans, the fans that you would always count on to be there no matter how low the numbers go. And I think we're going to look back on 2012 and these the birth of these three-hour Raws as a very bad thing that hopefully they'll have enough common sense. Even if it's not their call, they'll go to USA and say, listen, we can't do this anymore. I think we need to go back to the way things were. 2012 was also the year that we almost lost the King, Jerry the King Lawler, suffering a heart attack back in September on the air during Monday Night Raw. I don't like the fact that WWE has several times, in fact, since the King has returned, aired audio of him snoring and showed footage of him getting, electroshock backstage. I think that's a little too much. But, you know, a miracle in and of itself is not just the fact that Lawler survived the heart attack, but the fact that he was out for as long as he was, several minutes, and didn't suffer any sort of noticeable brain damage. You know, we've been very fortunate in that. Lawler has come back, and he's the Jerry Lawler of old. You know, he hasn't missed a beat. I do still feel that it would be better to change up the announcing situation. I have not changed my mind on that. I did a sound off earlier this year that predated Lawler's heart attack, I think by only a few weeks, ironically, if that, where I talked about the fact that Lawler is not what he used to be. You know, Lawler used to be a lot more entertaining on commentary when he played the antagonist to Jim Ross. You have the face-heel combo almost, and Lawler's, you know, his jokes have just gotten so tired and so played out. And, you know, not quite as bad as Taz. I mentioned on Sound Off 252 this weekend that Taz, to me, is an announcer who I used to like a lot. And now, you know, he's good every now and then, but he just comes off to me as being somebody who just, he's just there for the paycheck. You know, he just coasts, just doesn't seem to care. Lawler, I don't get the impression that Lawler doesn't necessarily care, but Lawler is there for the same reason. He's there to collect a paycheck. He doesn't particularly pay close attention to the product, and he's just not that entertaining, quite frankly. I think that they would be better off moving somebody like JBL from SmackDown to the Raw brand, or doing a split crew thing. As long as you insist on having three-hour Raw shows, then why not have an announce crew for the first half of the show and have a different announce team for the second half, and let Lawler do half the show. He doesn't have to do the full 3 hours. They haven't done that, nor do I think they will. But even so, it's still great to have the King back. It's great that he was able to make it. It was very scary that night. You know, it was a very scary thing, and seeing Michael Cole clearly terrified on camera, praying that his friend would make it. It's pretty stunning stuff that happened, but you know what? If it had to happen, it's a good thing it happened where it did. He was able to get the help that he needed. He took, was it 2 months or 3 months? I think it was only 2 months or so. And he was back. So good for Jerry. It's good to have him back, but that was a very scary moment. Another thing from this year, the revival of tag team wrestling in WWE. This has been something that is quite refreshing, I have to say. And I do think there's some influence at play here from Triple H. I don't know who is directly responsible, but whoever it is deserves a bonus. Because to me, tag team wrestling is still a very important part of wrestling. It may not be what it used to be. You know, you go back to the 80s, you could have house show tours, split tours, kind of like an A show and a B show. And on the B show, you could have two teams like the Bulldogs and the Hart Foundation headline. And back then, that still meant something. Now, forget about it. You know, now it has to be John Cena in the main event, or it has to be CM Punk or Sheamus or whoever the champion is. So they still don't really rely on tag team wrestling. They don't trust it quite that much. They just don't think that it's big box office. And I think it can be, but what do I know? But still, it's good to see them actually put some sort of emphasis back on tag team wrestling, because the tag team division in WWE has been dead and non-existent for far too long. Now at least they've got Hell No, and I'm not a big fan of makeshift tag teams. I've made that clear before. Kane and Daniel Bryan are the definition of a makeshift tag team. Both former world champions, both are singles competitors that just happen to be paired together. But they've been very entertaining together. They really helped get this whole thing off the ground, really, if you think about it. They brought some relevance back to those tag team belts. You've got Hell No, you've got the Rhodes Scholars, also two singles guys, although in that case, I think that the two parts kind of make them better as a complete unit. And I think they'll still be big stars singles at some point, but I'm a big fan, actually, of the Rhodes Scholars. You have Rey Mysterio and Sin Cara. They're trying to put Rey with him to take Sin Cara under his wing, and I think Sin Cara's gotten better. You know, people still make fun of him. They call him Botch Cara and stuff like that, because I just think it's kind of the cool thing for them to do. He's fine. He just gets hurt way too much, but they work well together as a team. They brought some life to the tag team division. The Primetime Players, who at one point earlier this year were managed by AW, Abraham Washington. And the idea was, not so much, I don't think, to get the Primetime Players over. The idea was to get Abraham Washington over and his All World Enterprises was the name of his group. He was going to probably bring other people into his faction. I remember him on that Raw the night after WrestleMania. You know, Mark Henry was unsuccessful in his championship match against CM Punk. He went backstage. He was throwing furniture around. AW comes up, gives him his business card. They had plans to start an actual faction with this guy. And I believe he was with Primo and Epico. Was he with Primo and Epico at one point? I don't remember. But anyway, AW shot his mouth off, said some stuff that he should not have, had one very tasteless joke that he said on the air at ringside during a Primetime Players match. It was basically a rape joke, and that don't fly in PG, WWE. TMZ picked up on it. He was fired, and he freaked out. I mean, AW is the classic example, if you don't want to burn any bridges, of what not to do when you get let go by WWE, or any company, for that matter. And I was one of the many people who thought, all right, that's it. You know, poor Darren Young and Titus O'Neil, they're doomed. But to my surprise, not that they've necessarily been booked, you know, to perfection or anything. They still have not held the tag team belts. They still lose, I think, far too often. But to my surprise, the Primetime Players actually thrived without AW. They've developed into a very entertaining act. I like the Primetime Players a lot. In fact, they guest hosted one of WWE's YouTube shows. I think it was their Inbox show, maybe, they have on YouTube. This is in the last few weeks. If you haven't seen it, which most people probably have not, I would advise checking out that episode with Titus and Darren as the hosts. Very entertaining. I wish they would let them loose like that a little bit more on TV. So they've been a pleasant surprise. You have the Usos, as well as Tyson Kidd and Justin Gabriel, another makeshift team. But those are two very underrated teams. I mentioned this on episode 252. I like seeing them on the Christmas Eve edition of Raw. They were one of the few things I actually enjoyed about that Christmas Eve edition of Raw, which we will never speak of again. These are two teams that are very, very good. They get the crowd into their match, especially the Usos. They're very good at getting the people involved and the people to cheer and chant, you know, Uso and all that stuff. And they've gotten better. And I'm hoping that 2013 has better things for both those teams, even if that doesn't necessarily mean, you know, the tag belts. But hopefully they could be more prominently featured. They could make some appearances on Raw, which is the flagship show, get some TV time. And hopefully we'll have a few more tag teams. I think another two or three solid tag teams. Because like I said, Hell No, they're not going to make it for 2013 as a tag team. You know, Kane and Daniel Bryan, I'm sure for the first part of the new year, will still be together. But I think their days are numbered. And I think at some point you got to break them up and you got to let Daniel Bryan, who I fear is in jeopardy of being branded as nothing more than a comedy figure, at some point you've got to stop that and make them singles again. And they're still going to need some tag teams that can be put on television and can be entertaining and can kind of fill that role when Kane and Daniel Bryan go their separate ways. Now, they have this team in developmental called the Ascension, which is no more because one of them got fired for DUI. They could try to plug somebody else in his place. I don't know if they're going to or not. I don't know of any other you know, major tag teams they have down there right now, so they may have to take two guys and put them together. But I think another two or three solid teams, and the tag team division looks good. It looks promising heading into 2013. 2012 has also been the year of CM Punk. His reign as WWE champion now exceeding 400 days, the longest reigning champion in over 25 years since the initial Hogan run in the 1980s, which is very impressive. This is not an era where you expect somebody to have a title reign like this. This is the era of ADD. You know, PG equals ADD, you might say, because these guys, they're very impatient. They can't keep the belt on somebody for more than a few weeks, a few months, if even that. And CM Punk, I think, has been the beneficiary of The Rock. I think he has The Rock to thank for being WWE champion as long as he has, because the minute they decided to book this match at the Royal Rumble, with The Rock getting a championship match, tempted as they may have been to take the title off Punk and maybe change plans, they've held their ground. It will be CM Punk and The Rock for the championship at the Royal Rumble. I don't expect Ryback to win the title, for example, on January 7th, which sucks for Ryback, but it would be the wrong thing to do. But because they've had this match booked for so many months, it made it easier for them to keep the title on Punk, even at a time when Raw has seen some of its lowest ratings in 15 years. If this were anybody else, if this were any other situation, the first time Raw's numbers fell as low as they did, they would have taken that title off Punk so fast your head would spin. So, you know, he's got a lot to be thankful for in that respect. And I don't blame him entirely for Raw, you know, doing as poorly as it has. There's a lot of different factors that go into it, even though Punk has never really proven to be a ratings draw, ever, even when he was a babyface. But I think as champion, both as a face and a heel, he's done a tremendous job. You know, he takes pride in his work. He's beat himself up. He had the knee injury. He's probably got other injuries he's nursing, too, that he's not telling anybody. He's been running ragged, although he's always had bags under his eyes, but those bags have become bigger. He has done a tremendous job as champion. You know, he has had some tremendous matches this year against Daniel Bryan, against John Cena, among others, Dolph Ziggler, Chris Jericho. And I think that he has restored some value to the championship that it was lacking before. You know, I really think it means more now than it did before he was champion. And that's what we need. We need more value, I think, restored to the top titles. I think we need only one title. I don't see that happening anytime soon. But Punk's reign as champion has been quite refreshing because, you know, we haven't seen anything like this in years. You know, John Cena would be the closest thing we've seen. Cena lost the title. His reign came to an end back in 07 because of an injury, thanks to Mr. Kennedy on a hip toss. But you know, Punk's reign as champion has been very enjoyable. He's done some of the best mic work, I think, of his career. I said before, him and Paul Heyman together make a great combination. Paul Heyman coming out, holding up the championship, you know, talking about Punk as the reigning, defending WWE champion. It's a great act. I'm almost going to be sad when it comes to an end next year, most likely at the Royal Rumble. And if for some reason they change their minds, if somehow, by hook or crook, Punk does make it past The Rock, he ain't going to be champion coming out of WrestleMania. I think we know that. So his days are numbered, but I think, Punk has had a tremendous year. He deserves a lot of credit. He's restored a lot of value to the belt. And that's one of the highlights for me in WWE of 2012 is the reign of CM Punk. One of the highlights has also been Daniel Bryan. Daniel Bryan and the Yes Chant. The Yes Chant, there were people who thought the Yes Chant might actually replace the what chants. I never actually bought into that, and obviously that has not happened, unfortunately. Believe me, nobody would have been happier for the yes chant to replace the what chant than I would have been, but that has not happened. But Daniel Bryan also has had a tremendous year. Here's a guy who, I'm sure there were people out there who looked at him as some indie geek who would never make it past a certain level in WWE, and he's proven everybody wrong. He started the year as World Heavyweight Champion. He went into his first WrestleMania as the World Heavyweight Champion. The combination with him and AJ, hey, he was AJ's first, if you think about it. And she's been through a lot of guys since then. The matches that he had with CM Punk were some of the best in WWE all year. You know, from Over the Limit, their first pay-per-view match, their second one at No Way Out, Money in the Bank, I guess, was kind of the blow-off to that. Right into the whole storyline with him and Kane, and this whole Team Hell No combination, which I think is kind of playing itself out a little bit, but it was very, very entertaining at first. It was very funny. And, you know, now the whole thing with Goatface, he's grown out the beard. To me, you can point to a few people, I suppose, as being the quote, MVPs of WWE this year. Sheamus comes to mind as far as in-ring is concerned. He's proven to be an MVP for the company. But Daniel Bryan, to me, is the MVP of WWE this year. You know, CM Punk, I guess you can make that argument as well. Because if they lost CM Punk to a major injury, that would have been a very big blow. But I look at Daniel Bryan as being one of those MVPs for the company. He can do anything. He's very versatile. He can play babyface. He can play heel. He could be a tag wrestler. He could be a singles wrestler. He could be a submission specialist. He can do, you know, comedy matches on Saturday Morning Slam. He can do publicity for the company. He's a very nice guy, a very likable guy. We got to interview him. I mean, the guy is the consummate performer. He can do whatever you ask him to do. And one of the great things that I've enjoyed seeing is him growing to become the kind of performer that everybody could look at and say, hey, this guy's pretty good. Because, you know, back then, I mean, for years, even on my own show, on my own podcast, I would crow about how good Bryan Danielson was. You know, I used to go watch him at the Ring of Honor shows. I can't wait until he's on the main roster in WWE. Talked about how great he was. And there were people who didn't know anything of him. They didn't believe me. They figured, okay, it's the next indie geek. Everybody, you know, probably goes into the ring and does all these flips and moves and dives and shit. And it's taken a little while, but I think pretty much everybody has come around to how great a performer Daniel Bryan is. And there he is on television every week, you know, probably making a lot of money. And like I said, former world champion. And I could not be any happier for the guy. This was the year that Daniel Bryan truly came into his own as a WWE performer. And I think began to be taken seriously, quite frankly. And they see the value in him. And I think he's probably set for life. He's probably got a job for life if he wants it. I can think of few other performers that have been as valuable to the company, either brand, Raw or SmackDown, as Daniel Bryan has been. And those yes chants, like I said, never forget that night on Raw, the night after WrestleMania. You had to be in the building that night to really experience the magic, I think, of what that was. And then even leaving the building, walking through the hallways, the corridors of the arena with the people chanting yes, in the parking garage with the people chanting yes, outside the arena with the people chanting yes. It was something else. It was definitely something else. Randy Orton had a not-so-banner year in his career, let's just say that much. And one story that perhaps some people may have forgotten and may have been lost in the course of everything that happened this year, but something very big happened with Randy Orton this year. And that is the fact that he was suspended for 60 days for a wellness violation. WWE made the announcement back on May 30th on their website that Randy Orton had been suspended for 60 days. It was his second official. Some people would argue it should have been his third. But it was his second recognized wellness violation. And we all know what happens if he gets popped for a third time. Randy Orton goes bye-bye for at least 1 year. And I don't think anybody wants that to happen. But Randy Orton, since he has come back from that suspension, has not been very prominently featured on WWE television. And this is a guy who at one time was the WWE champion, former world heavyweight champion, pay-per-view headliner, main evented against John Cena, all the big stars. And it's almost as though the company doesn't trust him enough now. Even if he walks the straight and narrow and doesn't get into trouble, he is in a very elite class, along with, I believe, Rey Mysterio may also have two strikes, where they can ill afford to put him in a prominent position, to put a title on him, for example. And I'm not saying he'll never be champion again. I do believe he'll be champion again. And he wants to turn heel, and I think they've probably got plans for him to turn heel. He may well challenge for the championship as a heel at WrestleMania 29 against Sheamus. But since he has come back, Randy Orton has not looked like a main event star. He has not been featured in one single pay-per-view main event. And I think that that's a much bigger deal than people are making it out to be. I mean, this is a guy who a lot of people looked at, and perhaps still do, as the future of the company. And the future now is in doubt, not just because of the suspension. The suspension is the biggest part of it. But he's also very injury-prone. You know, I saw the match. I saw the clip. I should say, I didn't watch Tribute to the Troops, but I saw the clip from the tag team match. It was him and, I think it was him and Sheamus against Ziggler and Big Show. And Randy Orton just threw a punch. and his arm came out of the socket. Now, he's had shoulder issues before. Popped his shoulder back in, took a couple of weeks off. I believe he's ready to come back now, so it's not a serious injury. But you've got to ask yourself, you know, how much longer is Randy Orton going to last between, you know, there's no wiggle room on the suspensions anymore. So he can't get popped for a wellness violation or else he's gone. But can his shoulder and his collarbone, which have been injury prone before, can they hold up? Will Randy Orton ever again be as prominently featured as a main eventer as he was, say, 3 or 4 years ago? I do think he'll be champion again, but I don't know. You know, those days may be over. I don't know what the future holds for Randy Orton, but it became a lot cloudier this year when he got suspended for the second time. Ryback broke out as a main event star this year on the WWE roster. They need more they need more main event guys. Say what you want to about Ryback. I think he's getting better. You know, you could say he's one-dimensional. He's a Goldberg clone. He's really not, but again, it's cool, I guess, for people to say that. But WWE needs more people to break out into the main event, and Ryback has done that, and that's a big deal. They made a new star. You know, when he came back, and he came back from a pretty horrific ankle injury. I mean, that ankle injury, he had to have multiple surgeries. He was out for like a year and a half, and he came back, and they did the gimmick with him battling the jobbers on TV, two at a time, three at a time, and I did a commentary on one of my Sound Off episodes many months ago that basically said, listen, Vince McMahon, WWE, have to make a decision here. It's time for them to shit or get off the pot. You can't keep doing these jobber matches with Ryback. They started to get old. At some point, you have to say, okay, we're either going to push this guy and feed him some real competition, or we're not going to push him anymore. He'll be slotted at a certain level in the mid-card, the low mid-card, and that's as good as he's going to get. Or we'll make him a comedy babyface or something. And I was hoping and figuring that they wouldn't do that, that they would push him, and they did. Now, my idea was a little bit different. They kind of threw him right into the fire because John Cena got hurt. They needed a new pay-per-view main event. And, I mean, literally, I mean, from within like a two-week time span, Ryback went from beating jobbers on TV to headlining a pay-per-view for the championship against CM Punk. My idea would have been to kind of ease him into it and to actually borrow a page from the way that Goldberg was pushed initially in WCW. I think that Ryback should have been kept undefeated for longer. I think it would have been good to put a championship on him, that being the Intercontinental title. I think a feud with him and Miz, where in the end he would just destroy Miz, win the championship, and can defend the IC title for a while and eventually get tired of that and move on to the world championship. But WWE felt they had to put somebody in that position, and they pushed Ryback. I don't want to say they pushed him too fast too soon. They definitely pushed him faster than I would have. But, hey, Hell in a Cell did a hell of a buy rate. Bigger buy rate than it's done in years. And a lot of that could probably be credited either to Ryback or probably just the idea that, hey, we got somebody other than John Cena in the main event wrestling for the championship. It's funny how that works when you put some fresh blood in the main event picture. So, Ryback, I think, has done very well in his role. He's obviously over. You know, his Feed Me More catchphrase has gotten over. He's done very well for himself. And I think he'll continue to do well for himself into next year as well. I'll have a prediction on him as well in just a few minutes. Speaking of breakout stars, on the diva side, I don't think anybody's had as good of a year as AJ Lee. She has become probably the most prominently featured or successful diva since Trish Stratus and Lita. Some people would say that was the golden age of women's wrestling in WWE, at least in the last 10 years or so. When Trish was around and Lita, they had their feud, and they were two of the most popular divas the company's ever seen. I mean, they're right up there with, you know, Sunny and Sable and Chyna. And AJ, you can put her in that class now too. Maybe not as an in-ring performer, but certainly as far as an on-screen character is concerned, has there been any other diva to get as much screen time, and in the main event no less, as AJ Lee? I don't think so. You know, she started the year as the valet for Daniel Bryan. She was just verbally abused week in and week out, just almost like Miss Elizabeth, the Macho Man, Miss Elizabeth dynamic. Back when Savage first came in, he was the heel. He would always mistreat Elizabeth and, you know, berate her and Mean Gene would go to interview her, but he wouldn't let her speak, and she would have to hold the ropes open for him and all that stuff. That's kind of what it reminded me of a little bit. And then AJ finally grew a spine. She had a stint as the general manager of Monday Night Raw, which is a big deal. So that was a pretty prominent role for her to be in. There was the whole love triangle before that with her and CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, Kane. She actually kissed Kane on TV. That's one of the more memorable moments from Raw this year. That and the night that she started skipping around the ring wearing a Kane mask, that was pretty freaky. To what she's doing now, you know, the stuff with John Cena. She turned on John Cena. Now she's with CM Punk, Dolph Ziggler, rather, and Big E Langston. So AJ started the year in a pretty prominent position, managing the world champion, and she ends the year managing Mr. Money in the Bank, the future world champion, most likely. So AJ has had about as good a year as any diva, I think, in company history. And she's done very, very well in that role. She's very cute, very attractive, and all that, so it works. But she plays her role, I think, perfectly. She really is very good in the role, which is pretty incredible given the fact that, you know, you hear people who know her, and they say that in real life she cannot be anywhere any more opposite in real life to her character than she is. So I give her a lot of credit. I think she's done a hell of a job, and I think she'll be even more prominently featured in 2013. The evolution of Dolph Ziggler continued this year as well. He had a pretty big year in 2011, a bigger year, though, in 2012. He ate countless brogue kicks. I mean, I don't even know how many times he got kicked in the face by Sheamus and pinned. But in the end, you know, the expression is, it's not how you start, it's how you finish. And I think Dolph Ziggler ended 2012 in a pretty good position, beating John Cena in the main event on pay-per-view to retain his Money in the Bank briefcase. He won the Money in the Bank briefcase and essentially won it a second time by beating John Cena in the main event. And I think in many ways, beating John Cena was a bigger deal than winning a Money in the Bank ladder match. You got a Money in the Bank ladder match with a bunch of mid-card guys. You know, that's all well and good, but beating the face of the company in the main event on pay-per-view, to me, is a much bigger deal. And it makes a much bigger statement. And that's, I think, the key for Dolph Ziggler, is going into 2013, the man has now made a statement. And he's got AJ Lee as his valet. So obviously they have plans for Ziggler. You know, they're not going to waste AJ on somebody who's not worth the time and effort. They've got Big E Langston with them as well as kind of the bodyguard, I guess. And 2013, I feel like, is going to be Ziggler's year. But this year was very important in the continued evolution of his character. A year ago, he lost the United States Championship to Zack Ryder on pay-per-view, and this year, it was almost like a 180. So, you know, he was already getting the push prior to this year, but this was the year where I think he really kind of broke through, and people said, okay, we can trust this guy. This guy right here is the future. He's going to be a big star, and let's stop beating him and start actually promoting him. We saw a lot of people this year from developmental get called up. In fact, of late, it feels like a ton of developmental guys have been called up of late. But no three bigger names to me than The Shield. And in particular, Dean Ambrose and Seth Rollins. I, like many other people, have been waiting so long for these two guys to get called up. Seth Rollins, the former Tyler Black from Ring of Honor, he has been dwindling down in developmental for years now, it feels like. Dean Ambrose hasn't been down there for quite as long. But there was all these rumors, these guys are going to get called up soon. They started an angle earlier this year, if you remember, right around WrestleMania time, with Dean Ambrose and Mick Foley. You know, they started something, they would argue on Twitter and stuff, but there was a taped confrontation outside, I think, a hotel in Miami where Ambrose was heckling him, and it was getting kind of serious there for a while. And somebody, it may have been Triple H, you know, that's the rumor, I don't know. Triple H has never been Mick Foley's biggest fan, which I don't understand at all, because to me, Mick Foley has perhaps done more to help get Triple H over as a main eventer early in his career than anybody else has Mick Foley. But anyway, they dropped that angle cold. Whatever they had planned between them, they dropped it like a bad habit. And I was a little worried about that, because I thought there was real potential there to introduce Ambrose in a high-profile feud with somebody like Foley, who I think the fans still look at as a main eventer. They still look at Foley as a big star, maybe not as big as he used to be. So I was pleasantly surprised when he came up as part of this group at Survivor Series, him and Rollins together, along with Roman Reigns. Now, I did not know very much about Roman Reigns. I had seen him before. I knew of him. I did not see very many of his matches. I figured, okay, well, we have one guy in this group who's bigger than the rest, which is, you know, Vince's MO, of course. He's got to have a big guy in the group, and so there he is. But I will say, you know, so far so good with the Shield. I have been very impressed by all three, not just Rollins and Ambrose. I mean, I would have expected them to be good no matter what, but Roman Reigns has also showed me something. I've been very impressed by the Shield, their promos. I've been very impressed by the Shield matches I've seen. There's only been one match on TV, and I'm going to talk about that in a second. They had a match at Madison Square Garden, a live event that I was at this past Thursday. Also very good, maybe the second best match of the entire show. They worked very well together. I think all three are going to be big stars in WWE's future. You know, normally when you get a group like this, you've had groups like Evolution over the years and stuff. You say, okay, this guy's going to be a big star. You know, which guy from the group is going to break out? And there will be somebody who breaks out first. But I think all three of them are going to be big stars. All three of them have the potential to be future world champions. These guys are the future of the company. These guys, along with some other guys that they got down to developmental, who are very good, who probably should already be on the main roster. But I think all three of them have a very bright future ahead of them, and I'm very excited to see where they go with them in 2013. Lastly here, this was also the year of the tout in WWE. And Twitter. Never discount Twitter. WWE has a multi-million dollar investment in this new endeavor, the tout, which I'm sure we've all seen on television now, these little 15-second videos that people record. I still don't understand what the point of it is. They were even pushing these touts at the house show I was at last week. They wanted people to tout videos from their phone, which I did not do, nor will I ever, by the way. So I understand that they have an investment in this company. They want to promote it. They want it to succeed. There are a few celebrities. I think Shaq, you know, touts and all that kind of stuff. I don't think tout is long for this world. I don't think tout's going to be around for that long. And thankfully, they have toned down the pushing of tout on Raw. It used to be, at one point this year, it was just unbearable. And they would show fan touts every week, which were just, oh my God. You talk about just dreadful. The touts that they would air on television, they were just completely embarrassing. So we don't have it shoved down our throat quite as much as we did at one point earlier this year. Twitter, on the other hand, that's a different story. They're still all over Twitter, which I just find comical because supposedly Vince McMahon loathes Twitter. He hates it. But he understands that, you know, Twitter is something that they have to use as their ally and their friend, and so he okays it and they promote it all the time. But yeah, never forget 2012, the year of the tout. And I am predicting a little early prediction here that tout, well, I don't want to say that tout is going to die in 2013. I do think the tout will die out, let's put it that way, in 2013. We probably won't even be talking about tout a year from now. So let's get to some awards really quick here. I've handed out some of my own sound-off awards here, so forget the Slammies, they don't mean shit. This is where it's at. Superstar of the Year. In WWE, I don't really think there could be any debate on this. CM Punk. CM Punk is the WWE champion. He was the WWE champion when 2012 started. He will be the WWE champion when the clock strikes midnight on New Year's Eve. And to me, for that reason alone, that is a very Superstar of the Year worthy accomplishment. But again, Punk has had a number of Match of the Year candidates this year, with in particular with Daniel Bryan. But, you know, with John Cena and, as I mentioned, even Chris Jericho and stuff like that, he has been, if not, you know what, I would say he probably has been the most important performer in the company, even more so than John Cena this year. And CM Punk is the Superstar of the Year. There really is no other person, I think, to consider for it. Breakout Star of the Year is a tie. I'm actually going to nominate two people for the Breakout Star of the Year award, and that would be one diva and one not diva, I guess you would say. One male superstar and one female. The male would be Ryback. Say what you want to about Ryback. He's a main event guy now, like it or not. He got over. It worked. And For that reason alone, I can't think of very many other people who you can honestly say, especially in such a short period of time, hey, that guy's a main eventer. That guy broke out of the pack. Ryback did. You know, Antonio Cesaro, hey, he's had a great year. Hasn't been around for the whole year, but neither has Ryback. But no, Antonio Cesaro's had a wonderful year. United States champion now for well over 100 days. Very impressive, very strong, had some pretty good matches. But not breakout star of the year. I always expected that you know, Claudio, as I still sometimes call him, would become a big star. And again, U.S. champion, very impressive. But the U.S. title, very different from being in a pay-per-view main event fighting for the WWE Championship. So that's why I'm not nominating Antonio Cesaro as the breakout star of the year. Cesaro's in that camp with guys like Sandow, for example. Some of the newer guys that I like very much. But to narrow it down to just one of them doesn't make sense because Ryback has had more success than all of them, really. So Ryback and also AJ Lee. I don't think anybody would argue that. AJ Lee has had a tremendous year. Like I said, more of a successful year perhaps than any other diva in the history of the company. And that includes Lita and that includes Trish Stratus. She has been so prominently featured. I mean, even Trish and Lita were not, you know, part of the main event feud. I mean, Lita was part of a main event act with Edge. But, you know, that was even a couple of years after she had already made her mark as a women's champion. You know, AJ is, she hasn't been women's champion, but, again, she's been with Punk, she's been with Bryan, she was kind of sort of with Kane, she was with Cena, now she's with Dolph. She's a little whore. But she has certainly broken out. I don't think anybody expected AJ to become as big of a star as she did. So Ryback and AJ are the two winners of the Breakout Star of the Year. Match of the Year in WWE. This was a tough one. And it shouldn't have been. Because I already had my Match of the Year staked out weeks ago. You know, but then TLC happened. And something happened that rarely happens, that I didn't expect to happen. And that is the last pay-per-view of the year had what I would consider to be the match of the year in WWE. And that is Ryback and Hell No against The Shield, which wasn't even supposed to happen. It was supposed to be a singles match between Ryback and CM Punk that, all due respect to Punk, I don't think that would have been match of the year. And instead, as a replacement, Punk going down with a knee injury, we had Ryback and Hell No against The Shield in The Shield's first match. There were so many factors about this match. Again, the fact that it wasn't even supposed to happen. It was happening on the last show of the year, where you would normally not expect to have a match of the year come from out of nowhere. And you have three guys in this match that were relatively unproven. I mean, they were unproven on WWE TV. Never had a match before. Never teamed up together in a big-time match like this. Their first time, their debut in the ring. And they hit a home run. They hit a grand slam, as far as I'm concerned. I was in the building at TLC, at the new Barclays Center in Brooklyn, their first Brooklyn pay-per-view. Lively crowd, hot crowd. There was not a dull moment in the entire match. It was nonstop action. It was everything a TLC match should be. There were some creative spots in there that they worked out. The superplex off the table, which was laid across the top rope. This was just 20 minutes of pure mayhem that was so much fun to watch live in the arena that I thought, okay, you know what? A lot of times when you go to these shows live, your perspective is a little bit different than it would be on TV. So I went home and I watched the match. I wanted to see the actual pay-per-view version. I thought it might change my mind, and it didn't. It only reinforced it in my mind. I watched it twice. And to me, Ryback and Hell No against The Shield at TLC is the match of the year in WWE. Only slightly edges out what would have been my match of the year. This would have been my match of the year up until 2 weeks ago. Number two, John Cena and Brock Lesnar from Extreme Rules. This was going to be my number one. Now it's number two. Very close number two. This was a pay-per-view main event in WWE. Let me preface this because, you know, TNA, ROH, some of the other independent promotions with their iPay-per-views, there have been some incredible matches. But in WWE, there's a certain formula they follow, right? There's a certain type of pay-per-view main event you've come to expect in WWE. This was unlike any main event that I've ever seen. I mean, in the first 30 seconds of this match, Brock Lesnar elbowed John Cena so hard, or clipped him by accident, whatever happened. Within the first 30 seconds of the match, John Cena was bleeding at a time when you don't see blood in WWE. So in the first 30 seconds, I knew, okay, this is something else here. This is something special. And all the people out there that have been tired of the John Cena character and have wanted to see him get just murdered, they got their wish on this show. Brock Lesnar beat the hell out of John Cena. And it felt like a fight. It really felt like, I don't want to say it felt real. That's not maybe not the right word. In a way, it kind of did. It felt like a realistic beating. Maybe that is the right word. You watch a normal pay-per-view main event, and it's your typical WWE match. They go through the spots, whatever. It's John Cena against whoever, this person, that person. This felt like a fight. It felt like John Cena was in a fight for his life. He was being murdered. He was being mauled. And really, in the end, the only reason he pulled it out was because he used a foreign object. He had to wrap a chain around his fist to gain the upper hand on Brock Lesnar and beat him with an attitude adjustment on the steel steps. That's the only reason John Cena won the match, right? So the story is that John Cena basically had to cheat to win and to escape with his life in that match. I think the finish was the wrong finish. I still disagree with it. I know why they did it. I don't care. I disagree. But even with the crappy finish, I felt like this was the match of the year. Just because it was intense, it was exciting, I thought, and it was so different. We need more of that. We need more, even the TLC match felt different, and I guess that wasn't the main event, but, we don't see matches like this much anymore on WWE television, so when we do, I think we enjoy it that much more. And the Cena-Lesnar match, I don't think we're ever going to see another match like that again. Lesnar wrestled again this year on pay-per-view against Triple H, but that was, compared to the Cena match, that was boring, as far as I'm concerned. So that would be my number two match of the year. Number three would be the Undertaker-Triple H end-of-an-era Hell in a Cell match at WrestleMania 28. Told a great story. It's one of the reasons I love the TLC match, actually, with Ryback and Hell No. It told a story. It wasn't just a bunch of guys beating the hell out of each other. The Shield would beat down one guy. They would gang up on one guy, get him out of the picture, move on to the next guy. There was a story being told there. Undertaker Triple H told a great story. Triple H doing everything in his power to try to keep this guy down. Undertaker will not quit. He will not die. He's telling Shawn Michaels, the referee, you better end it or I will. I'll kill this guy with this sledgehammer. And being there live in the stadium, it was hard for me to follow along because I couldn't hear all of this stuff that was going on, and it was tough. I was watching it basically on the Titantron, so I had to go back and watch it on television to get the full appreciation for it. But it was a hell of a match. These guys, with the chair and everything, they beat the hell out of each other. Undertaker had these bruises on his back when the match was over, he probably wasn't feeling too good the next morning. But it told a great story. Shawn Michaels, I thought, played his role great. The outcome was the correct one. Undertaker wins in the end, puts Triple H out of his misery. It was a great match. Not match of the year, but on my match of the year list, it would come in at number three. Number four would be CM Punk and Daniel Bryan, their first pay-per-view match at Over the Limit. I did not expect the crowd to be as into that match as they were. You don't expect the WWE audience to have as much of an appreciation for wrestling holds like these guys were busting out. But everybody was into it, and I remember, was it the surfboard? I think it was like the surfboard or something that Daniel Bryan put CM Punk in. We saw moves from these guys in this match that we hadn't seen before, and they had a wrestling clinic. It was nice to see a pure wrestling match get over the way that this match did with the crowd, and they didn't really beat Daniel Bryan. Punk won, but it was almost a fluky win. It was almost like a double pin type finish where, Bryan's shoulders were down. He didn't realize his shoulders were down, so he got pinned. But then almost immediately, CM Punk tapped out to the S-lock. And it kept the feud going for another two pay-per-view matches, which were almost as good. The Money in the Bank match actually may have been as good. It was a great match. But that Over the Limit match, to me, was the best of the bunch. Just if you're into wrestling, pure wrestling, none of the nonsense, that's the match for you. Pure wrestling match, as far as pay-per-view main events go, that probably was match of the year. But overall, it would be number four on my list. Number five, which also is no slouch, Sheamus and Daniel Bryan from Extreme Rules. They had a 2 out of 3 falls match for the World Heavyweight Championship. This match between the two of them at Extreme Rules was what their WrestleMania match should have been. And if these guys would have been allowed to go out there and have the kind of match they had here at WrestleMania, that pay-per-view would have been that much more special. And it would have made that much more, I think, of an impact. It was great. You know, they had a lot of drama in the match. Sheamus at one point was locked in the yes lock, wouldn't give up. He passed out. The psychology in the match was great. The wrestling in the match was great. The crowd was into it. You know, Sheamus beat him clean, bro kick 1-2-3 in the end, which is fine. You know, Sheamus won the title at WrestleMania. He was the guy they were pushing, and he should have won. But they've had some great matches, none better than this match. And I almost feel bad for putting this match at number 5. That's a... a good thing. I mean, that just shows how many great matches we saw this year. On other people's lists, this match could have easily been number 1 or number 2. But I would rank it at number 5. Those are 5 very strong matches, I think, that we saw this year on WWE television. Flop of the year. Can't believe this wasn't a category for the Slammies. Flop of the year. I think it's hard to argue that Raw moving to 3 hours hasn't been something of a flop. So I'd probably, I'm putting that at number 1. But not far behind that would be Tenzai. Tenzai made his big comeback this year to WWE, had been over in Japan doing his thing for many years. We hadn't seen him in a very long time. Came back with the Japanese warrior character, Sakamoto, as his manager. And the plan was to build him up as one of the top heels in the company. The plan was to put him right square in the middle of the John Cena-John Laurinaitis feud, where Laurinaitis would essentially bring in Tenzai almost as his hired hitman. He was going to be that prominently featured in a main event feud. And he did have a win over John Cena. They did let him beat John Cena once on Raw. He spit the mist in his face and gave him the Baldo bomb, I think, and pinned him. So they had big plans for Tenzai, and boy, did he fail. And I don't know that you can blame any one thing. You know, he seemed to be a little out of shape to me. He's gotten bigger, it seems, and not in a good way. He just seemed very slow moving in there. The gimmick didn't help. You know, you don't have to write Japanese characters, you know, tattooed Japanese letters in the guy's forehead. He wasn't allowed to cut normal promos. I mean, he very rarely was able to speak, and when he did, he was talking Japanese and nobody understood what he was saying. So of course people chanted, "What? What?" That's not how you get over. The guy's got some personality. Let him go out there and speak. So Tenzai was just a complete failure in every facet, I mean, that it could have possibly been. He's become the antithesis of a main event heel character to the point now where he's being groomed as a comedy babyface, which I think may be the best role for him. And perhaps at some point in the future you can maybe build him back up to being an upper mid-carder, possibly. But they did a lot of damage to him, and the character, look, they tried, but it just did not get over. It was truly one of the biggest flops of the year. And lastly, my guilty pleasure of the year, I admit, has to be the Funkasaurus, Brodus Clay, who has become a very low, I can't even call him a mid-card act, really. He's low mid-card. He's filler, essentially, is what he is. He made his debut in January. He was being promoted on television for weeks at the end of 2011. John Laurinaitis kept saying, Brodus Clay is coming back. I can't wait. Brodus is going to be back. And the last time we saw Brodus, he was with Alberto Del Rio. He was his heavy. He was wrestling also on Superstars. Not too many people probably saw it, but he was the big bad brute. He would go out there and just beat the piss out of people. And I thought that was the Brodus Clay that we were going to get. I was very excited to see Brodus Clay come back and re-debut on television as a big monster. And I was as shocked as the next person when he came out looking like, I don't know why, like Jumpin' Jack Flash or something. I don't know. He came out with the pimp hat and two very beautiful women, so I guess that's a plus. But he came out essentially as a comedy babyface, and they gave him the dancing fat man gimmick with pyro and hot women. I mean, they really spared no expense for his entrance. You would think they had big plans for the guy. And I don't know if it's just that they realized he wasn't very good in the ring, if he just, the gimmick fell out of favor with Vince McMahon or what happened, but boy... he was undefeated for a while, and then one day they just, I think, had Big Show knock him out on Raw, and they started beating him week after week after week. They clearly were not protecting him anymore, And now he, you know, he's just another guy on the roster. So, but for a certain amount of time earlier this year, I actually thought that this gimmick could work. I thought they could sell a ton of merchandise. I thought if they handled him correctly, he could be a big star. Maybe not a main event player like Cena or Punk, not with this gimmick. It's like people ask me, oh, do you think Zack Ryder can be a main event guy? No, I don't. Not with this gimmick. Maybe if he, you know, I don't know how Zack Ryder would be as a heel. I don't think he could pull it off. But, you know, Zack Ryder as the, you know, the goofball that he is now, he'll never be a main eventer, nor should he be. So I didn't expect Brodus Clay with this character to be a main eventer either. But I figured the way you handle the guy is when people push him and he gets pissed off, he snaps and he becomes a monster, the monster that everybody thought he was going to be. So it's almost like the Incredible Hulk, you know, when you make him mad. I think that would have been the way to handle the Brodus Clay character. Everybody knows the guy's got a mean streak. Don't fuck with him. And that's not the direction they went in. He just became a comedy character, and he means nothing now. But when he debuted, you can ask anybody. Ask Brian Blade. Ask Noah. I was a big fan of the Funkasaurus. I was a big fan of his theme song, WrestleMania, when he came out. People hated that segment with him and all the mamas when they came out and did the dancing bit. I mean, I didn't care for the dancing bit. I thought it was a waste of time. But when he came out of WrestleMania, I was dancing to the music. I mean, I was into the character. And I thought that it could be something, and I feel foolish now at the end of 2012. I think there was potential, and they squandered it. But the Funkasaurus was a guilty pleasure of mine in 2012. 2012 was also filled with a lot of memorable moments for Impact Wrestling, TNA. Bobby Roode became the longest reigning champion, supposedly, in the history of TNA, which is not exactly true. Jeff Jarrett did have a longer title run as the NWA TNA champion early on when he was the king, I guess you would say, the Triple H, so to speak, of TNA. But big year for Bobby Roode. James Storm, his former tag team partner, became the biggest loser of 2012. It's not only a television show anymore on NBC. When you hear biggest loser, you'll see a picture of James Storm's face. Because this guy, here's a guy who... The plan had been for him to win the world championship, which he did, okay, briefly, although I guess that would have been at the end of 2011. But he went into lockdown, one of TNA's biggest pay-per-views of the year, probably its second biggest pay-per-view of the year, behind Bound for Glory. And he had a match with Bobby Roode. And it was in, I think, Tennessee, his home state, right? Perfect place, you would think, for James Storm to... get revenge on the man who beat him over the head with a beer bottle, former tag team partner, win the championship in front of his home crowd fans. Didn't happen that way. He gave Bobby Roode a last call super kick and knocked Roode out of the cage. So essentially he cost himself the championship. It was just a really, I can't even say creative finish. It was a creative way to make the babyface look stupid, I guess. Maybe that's the best way to put it. And they did this storyline where Bobby, you know, Bobby Roode is still the champion, and James Storm doesn't know what to do, so he leaves. He's questioning himself. He doesn't know if he's going to continue to be a wrestler or if he's going to hang it up. Maybe he just doesn't have it in him anymore. And they draw this out for a while, and of course, James Storm does come back. They put him in the Bound for Glory series tournament. They gave him a 20-point head start, or he won a match. I don't remember how he got the points. He earned a 20-point head start. The plan was for him to win the Bound for Glory series and build him back up. His road to redemption would lead to Bound for Glory, and in the main event, he would get revenge and win the world championship back from Bobby Roode. Well, plans change. Didn't quite work out that way for him. In fact, he didn't win the Bound for... Not only did he not win the title, he didn't win the Bound for Glory series. Now, he and Bobby Roode did have a match at Bound for Glory, but it was the third match from the top, and it wasn't for the world championship. It probably was the best match at Bound for Glory, as it turned out. That probably would have been a hell of a main event if it would have gone down that way. It was a bloody match. But between that and then James Storm winning a title opportunity at one of the recent pay-per-views, and then putting it on the line against Bobby Roode on TV and losing it? Is there really a bigger loser than James Storm this year in TNA? You could say AJ Styles, I suppose. He hasn't exactly had a great year. I think James Storm is the biggest loser of 2012. Speaking of losers, Vince Russo's Reign of Terror came to an end this year in TNA. He was officially... Well, there's some question about whether he was fired or if he quit. I don't know that I would believe that Dixie Carter would ever fire Vince Russo. This woman just could not ever seem to bring herself to even consider firing Vince Russo, which doesn't speak very highly, I think, of her business skills. But whether it was Russo's decision or TNA's decision, I think essentially what happened is TNA forced him out. They forced him to make a decision to leave. They had promoted Bruce Pritchard to essentially head creative. A lot of his powers had been stripped away, and I think he just didn't like that, and he said, adios, I'm out of here, which could have been the best thing to ever happen to TNA. He officially left in February. Really wasn't until May or June, like around then, the beginning of the summer, that things creatively, I think, really began to pick up for TNA. Speaking for myself, I mean, I had always followed along with what was going on in TNA. I would watch a little bit of it here and there. I could not bring myself to watch TNA television. It was terrible. There were parts of it that may have been good, but you could see Russo's influence all over it, and it just was, it was awful. It was dreadful TV. They were stuck in this rut for so long. And when he left, you could tell. It didn't happen immediately, but within a reasonable amount of time, things began to change. Things began to make more sense. They slowed down a little bit. There was more wrestling. There were more stories being told that weren't so completely fucking ludicrous. And the product became much more enjoyable to follow. Watching a two-hour episode of Impact wasn't a chore. It was or you would watch Impact, and at the end of the 2 hours, you wouldn't be able to remember a goddamn thing that you just saw. And all of a sudden, that wasn't the case. You could follow along with the key storylines, and then they were, you know, bringing in new faces to have great matches. It was actually a really cool thing to be able to finally start watching TNA full-time, which I did when they first went live. May 31st, I believe, was the very first show. From that point on, I have pretty much seen all but maybe one episode of Impact Wrestling. It's become part of my weekly wrestling viewing because I am a wrestling fan, not just a WWE fan. I want to see good wrestling. I want to see TNA succeed. I want to see them grow and get bigger. It's not an easy thing to do, but it was the right move to make. Whether, again, they fired Russo, if they forced him out, whatever ended up happening, they did something that Russo did not like, and now he is gone. And he can go and retire and never be heard from again as far as I'm concerned. Because the TNA product, they have its good weeks, they have their bad weeks. It is much better than it was 6 months ago. It is a different product now. And that, to me, is the biggest story in TNA of 2012, was the departure of Vince Russo. And that is a change for the better. I don't care where they go in 2013. The biggest change they can make in 2012, they made, or it got made for them. But he's gone. And that's a good thing. And I mentioned before, May 31st was the first show that I started watching from. That's when Impact went live. Impact had previously been taped. And most weeks, if not every week. And it looks as though Impact is going to be live from now on. I don't remember hearing that it was a permanent move. I know they were angling for it. Spike TV kept adding additional live dates. As far as I know, when they come back, you know, January 3rd, they're going to be live. And I think from now on, Impact is probably, you know, for the most part, going to be live. And I think that's the way to go. I don't think it's a dramatic change to make. I mean, Impact the last few weeks has been taped with the holidays and everything. I thought this past Thursday the show was actually quite good. So, you know, live, you know, it does add, I guess, an aspect of unpredictability to things. And I don't like the idea that Impact is sitting in the can for 2 or 3 weeks. But them going live and getting rid of Russo, those were probably the two big moves the company made this year. Brooke Hogan also made her TNA debut on that May 31st show, as a matter of fact. Brooke has been hit or miss, mostly miss. They've been smart enough to not put her out in front of the crowd as often. A lot of times you see Brooke, it's backstage in taped segments with the knockouts. They made her the head of the knockouts division, the president of the knockouts, or whatever her title is. Obviously, it's nepotism at its best between her and Garrett Bischoff. We know why these people are getting pushed and promoted. It's obvious, you know. it is what it is. Again, I don't. There are weeks when I don't think Brooke is nearly as bad as people say she is, and then there'll be a week where she's even worse. Does it stop me from watching TNA television? Of course not. I've seen far worse actresses. Speaking of which, that brings me to Claire Lynch. Oh, Claire Lynch. I don't know whether to look at Claire Lynch as one of the best things to happen to Impact this year or one of the worst things to happen. It was certainly entertaining as hell for as long as it lasted. I've never heard of a wrestling angle before where they bring in an actress from the outside and the fans harass her so much that she just up and quits. Never heard of that happening before, but that's essentially what happened with the actress behind the Claire Lynch character. The whole Claire Lynch storyline was so ill-conceived that the company realized it about midway through, and they just aborted the entire thing. They decided, you know what, this sucks. This is so terrible. We're just going to go completely over-the-top ludicrous with it. And then one week, they just, you know, this was after she probably quit the company. They didn't have her anymore. Obviously, it would have been pretty hard to continue the storyline without the actress that was portraying her. So they literally just, you know, had the blow-off one week on Impact, and that was it. Now, there'll be a passing reference to the Claire Lynch angle without mentioning her name necessarily, but it's kind of a wink and a nod to how terrible they realized their own storyline was. And this woman's acting, I don't think there's any words that can truly understate how unbelievably bad she was in this role. Maybe she's a good actress. Maybe in a different role, in a different environment, she would be great. But she was terrible. She makes AJ Lee look like Katharine Hepburn. She was just god-awful. And, not a good year, I said before, for AJ Styles for a number of reasons. This would be chief reason number one. I think this is a year AJ Styles would like to forget, specifically because of the Claire Lynch storyline. I don't think AJ Styles even cares about the fact that he doesn't get a world title match now for another year. I think if there's one thing about this year he could change, it wouldn't even be that. He would like to take one of those devices that the Men in Black use to wipe people's memories clean, and he'd like to use that on all the fans and probably himself, so that nobody remembers anything about Claire Lynch. But I will say that I, in some weird, twisted way, I will look back on Claire Lynch and kind of miss the woman. You know, I'm a sadist, I know, I'm a masochist, what can I say? But there are a few storylines that make me just shake my head more than Claire Lynch did this year. Shook my head so much, I'm surprised I didn't, you know, have to live on Tylenol all the time. It was something else. It was definitely something else. We also had the birth of Open Fight Night and Gut Check. I've made no bones about the fact that I dislike Open Fight Night. I do like Gut Check, though. I like the idea behind it. I like the concept. I think it's a good thing. Open Fight Night, I have no use for it. But I give TNA a lot of credit on both counts because, you know what? They're coming up with ideas. They're trying to come up with new concepts and ideas for their TV show. They're trying to think outside the box. Sometimes it's going to work and sometimes it's not. But I appreciate when they do that, because I don't think WWE does enough of it. I don't think TNA does enough of it. So when they do, I think they should be complimented for it. So we saw the birth of those two concepts this year. We also had the death of Abyss and the rise of Joseph Park Esquire. And it may well be my favorite thing that TNA has ever done, this storyline here, this character transformation. I would be perfectly fine if Abyss never came back, if he was just left dead and buried, wherever he may be. God rest his soul. May he rest in peace. The Joe Park character, from the moment he first debuted on Impact, that very first segment where they showed him driving up to the entrance of the Impact Zone, talking to the security person, whatever, whoever they were, right up to the stuff they're doing now with the training vignettes down in OVW. I think it's just ingenious. And I think they should continue the training vignettes to the point where Joe Park learns the ropes, becomes a respectable wrestler, and just let him be the character that the guy portrays from now on. You can have Abyss make cameos here and there, but I think Joe Park is the way to go. I mean, this character has been an absolute breath of fresh air. He is amazing in the role. And, you know, it's a funny thing because we've seen examples of this over the years where you have a guy who goes most of his career wearing a mask. And when the mask comes off, It's almost like, why was he wearing a mask in the first place? Because, you know, the facial expressions, the mannerisms, you can only express yourself facially so much if you're wearing a frickin' mask. But Joe Park, he's been great in this role. He's fantastic. Alberto Del Rio, for years when he was down in Mexico, he wore a mask. He was a babyface luchador. Dos Caras Jr. went to WWE. They told him, no mask. You're going to be a heel. And, you know, you see Del Rio come out as the heel character, and his facial expressions, he doesn't do it as much lately, but, you know, when he first debuted, he was doing that winking a lot. It was genius. It was great stuff. And you think to yourself, God, they made this guy wear a mask? Or he opted to wear a mask for so many years? What a waste. Now, maybe Kane is the opposite. See, Kane, I think, is much better with the mask. I was never a fan of Kane without the mask. Just wasn't a fan. So there are exceptions to that. But I think in this case, this is proof positive that there are guys who wear masks who would probably be much better off having them ripped off their face. I think this is, Exhibit A when it comes to that sort of thing. We also had the rebirth of Bully Ray, both as a heel, now as a babyface, even though I still think he's going to end up as a heel. Bully Ray, a guy who was over 40 years old and was known for most of his career as a tag team wrestler. He was part of the Dudley Boys, a tag team that when they left WWE was so totally stale and so totally played out that I figured, all right, these guys are going to go to TNA, they'll have another tag title run, they'll work with some of the younger teams, and that'll be that. And what they both have done, and, you know, D-Von deserves some credit too, because he's gotten himself into good shape. I'm not a big fan of D-Von with this whole Aces and Eights bullshit now, but they both deserve a lot of credit, but Bully Ray more so. Bully Ray has just completely reinvented himself. I don't look at Bully Ray anymore as a tag team guy. It takes a lot to really break people's impression of you when you're branded a certain way, and to me, Bully Ray has done that. I don't look at him as a tag team guy anymore. He's Bully Ray. If he ever went back to WWE, I don't really care to see a Dudley Boys reunion. I'd rather see him portraying the Bully Ray character, which in PG WWE is never going to happen, so I'd rather he just stay where he is. I think he's done a tremendous job. And it's been something to watch. His promos, I mean, his in-ring work, I mean, you know, he's fine. I don't think he's, an exceptional wrestler or anything like that. He's fine. But it's the character. It's the interviews. He has really broken out of the pack. And it's been something pleasurable to watch. And also, Austin Aries has come of age in TNA this year. You know, he won the X Division Championship. I think he's the longest reigning X Division champion of all time, and gave up the title to face Bobby Roode at Destination X, and he won the World Heavyweight Championship. They broke from the plan, which was always to keep the belt on Bobby, full steam ahead at Bound for Glory, him and James Storm, and they realized they had something with this Austin Aries guy. The fans are into him. Let's give them what they want. And that was a great moment at Destination X when he won the championship and they had the confetti and everything and I think some pyro, and it was great stuff. And for as great as a babyface, I thought as champion, as Austin Aries was, he's proven to be an even better heel. He's such a dick. And there is no better person, I think, in TNA to portray being a dick than Austin Aries. Bully Ray may come close, because when he's a dick, he's a real dick. But Austin Aries takes the cake, and you know, the other thing also is they developed a new gimmick where from now on, whoever is the X Division champion come, you know, summertime, has the option of either continuing on as the X Division champion or giving up the title in favor of a world title match at the Destination X pay-per-view. I think that's a cool concept. And it started with Austin Aries. And here's a guy, I keep going back to this. Here's a guy who was in TNA at one point. Remember, he was Austin Starr many years ago. Didn't work out, didn't leave on the best of terms, went back to Ring of Honor, which is where he really made a name for himself, former Ring of Honor World Heavyweight Champion, I believe on two separate occasions, ended up back in TNA really only because he tried out for Tough Enough, that new season of Tough Enough last year with Stone Cold and Bill DeMott and Booker T and Trish Stratus, and he was on the list of people that Shed Media, the production company, wanted to be on the show. And when Kevin Dunn and WWE got a hold of the list and they saw people like Austin Aries' name on there, they said, no. We don't want this guy on here. So he wasn't even good enough for the Tough Enough roster. And think about that. Think about how many people from Tough Enough are still left in WWE. I think it may only be one person. I think it's the one Funkasaurus who actually doesn't even know how to wrestle. It's the other Funkasaurus that's a good wrestler, Naomi. But Cameron, the drunk, is the only one left. Think about that. And Austin Aries, I guess, wasn't good enough for that show. So he ends up back in TNA, using his name. And he becomes a big star. He gets over on his own. It was nothing TNA did. I mean, they gave him a chance. But he got himself over. And whether it was as the champion, now as a heel, I'm very happy that he lost the title and didn't just get relegated back down to the mid-card. He's still a main event guy. And he's doing very well for himself. And it's really cool to see. And in a way, it's kind of like a nice FU to Kevin Dunn and WWE. Look what you could have had. TNA also gave us the best damn tag team, in my opinion, in all of wrestling. Daniels and Kazarian, or Bad Influence, as they are now called. These guys work tremendously well together. They are the single most entertaining tag team in all of wrestling. Certainly amongst the two big companies, anyway. And there are similarities here to, like, the Rhodes Scholars in WWE, for example. I'm a fan of theirs. I think Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow are very entertaining. They work very well together. But the chemistry that Daniels and Kazarian have, the great in-ring performers that both of them are, quite frankly. I think both of them are much better in-ring performers than Cody Rhodes and Damian Sandow, who are good in their own right. But, you know, Daniels and Kazarian are the total package. They're very good wrestlers. They're very good in their roles as entertainers. They know exactly how these characters should be portrayed. Christopher Daniels, to me, and he also, is 40 years old. So he's a lot closer to the end of his career than he is the beginning of it. I mean, he's been wrestling on the independents for just years and years. And never had a big break. He's been in TNA for a while, but to me, this is really where he came into his own. And he's just great. I mean, you know, they're one of the bright spots every week on Impact, no matter what they're doing. If anything, I feel they're underutilized. They should be the tag team champions. They should have a nice long run with the belts, and then, really be built up to lose them to the next big team, whoever that may be. I don't think that's Chavo and Hernandez, personally. But even without the belts, they're great. They've got their Zubaz pants and their Gangnam Style dance. And no matter what they do, they're just highly entertaining, very funny. I enjoy watching them. It's been one of the high points, like I said, this year of TNA, is watching Daniels and Kazarian really come into their own and develop a tag team, you know, act that I'm going to be very upset about when the time comes they break them up. And you know that it's going to happen. It probably will happen in 2013 even. But when that day comes they break these guys up, I'm going to be very upset. Because unless they plan on promoting either one of these guys to, you know, a world title feud, I mean, I guess Frankie Kazarian more so than Daniels. I could see Kazarian at some point, if he continues to get better, potentially fighting for the world championship at some point, but this is just the perfect role for these guys. You know, why would they want to break them up? Hopefully they don't do that. But they're great. Another big thing happened in TNA this year that, again, I don't know that too many people either remember, know about, focus on too much, but can't be understated, is the departure of Don West. Don West has been with TNA since the very beginning. Don West is that crazy guy you used to see on those Home Shopping Network shows. Or whatever shopping network, QVC, whatever it may have been, hawking baseball cards and baseball memorabilia, shouting at the top of his lungs with that raspy voice at 2:30 in the morning. I didn't understand it when he came to TNA. I didn't get it. But as bad as he was at the beginning, and believe me, Don West was really bad when he first started out, just very obnoxious, screaming and shouting, and then Mike Tenay felt the need to compete with him, so all of a sudden, on commentary, Mike Tenay was shouting, and he was shouting, and they would go back and forth, and I couldn't take it anymore. Don West got better over time. He got much better as an announcer. They turned him heel at one point. He was actually a television character for a brief period of time. He was actually a manager. He managed The Amazing Red. A lot of people may not remember that. I thought there was great potential in Don West as a manager, maybe even with a little stable of his own. And unfortunately, I think it was after Bischoff and Hogan came in. For whatever reason, I don't know if they didn't like Don West or they just didn't think that was the right role for him. But they put the kibosh on that whole thing, as I recall, and he went back to being just an announcer. But being an announcer was something that, while it may not have come naturally to him at first, he got very good at it over time, to the point where I thought he was maybe the best play-by-play guy between the two companies, even better than Jerry Lawler. You know, at least Don West brought some life. He brought some emotion to the product. And the most important role that he played wasn't even on TV. It was actually behind the scenes as the head merchandise guru for TNA and TNA Shop. And a couple of the TNA shows I have been to, live events over the years, watching him run around and promote the T-shirts and the brown bag specials and the DVDs and the belts and the action figures, his face would be beet red. He'd be going 120%. I thought the guy was going to drop dead of a heart attack. I mean, legitimately worried about the guy every time I saw him. There's a picture up on my Facebook page of me with Don West at one of the baseball shows in Brooklyn. Just a really nice guy, very good at his job. TNA, you know, their merchandise sales have not been the same since he left. I knew when I heard he was leaving, I knew it was going to have a negative impact on them. And it has. I think they have felt the sting of Don West not being there, at least when it comes to their merch. But he went off to work, I think, for some minor league hockey team, if I'm not mistaken. I think in Washington State, he's much happier now, and that's good for him. But that was bad for TNA. That was a very big loss that I don't think gets enough attention, because Don West was very good at what he did, and a lot of people very sad to see him go. Sting became the first inductee this year into the brand new TNA Wrestling Hall of Fame. I didn't know if they were going to induct one person, a group of people. Obviously, they just inducted one. I'm not sure if they're going to induct more than just one in upcoming years, but they basically have followed the WrestleMania formula, and as part of their big Bound for Glory weekend every year, I suspect they'll have a Hall of Fame induction ceremony to go along with it. Sting was the first inductee. A worthy candidate, I think. You could have said Don West, even. Or Jeff Jarrett, or any of those performers and personalities that have been there from the very beginning would have been deserving. Sting did make an appearance long before his supposed debut in 2006. He actually, I think he made an appearance in TNA as early as 2002. But they talk about his debut being in 2006. And Sting is a big name from the past who has really shown a sense of loyalty to TNA that other people have not. He is not gone, nor do I think he will ever go to WWE for a run anyway. I do think he'll be in the Hall of Fame there one year at some point. But, you know, Sting has shown loyalty to TNA. He keeps coming back, and I'm sure he makes good money and gets good deal to keep coming back. But, you know, a very deserving entry, I think, into the Hall of Fame. It's hard for me to believe that this was Sting's first ever wrestling Hall of Fame induction. No other Hall of Fame, WWE Hall of Fame, no wrestling newsletter Hall of Fame, the Pro Wrestling Hall of Fame up in Amsterdam, New York. I don't think Sting has ever been inducted into a Hall of Fame of any kind before. This I believe, was legitimately his first. And I'm not saying Sting was always, you know, the greatest in-ring performer, but I just find that hard to believe, because Sting has been a big star on top since the late 80s when Ric Flair made him in that Clash of the Champions match. He's been basically a headline guy ever since. And, it's hard to believe, but he got his just desserts with TNA this year. Jeff Hardy regained the World Heavyweight Championship at Bound for Glory. Seems to have turned his life around after being in a nasty spiral. I think we all remember the debacle from Victory Road last year. I'm sure Jeff would like to forget that. And the drug charges, all the crap he went through. He seems to be walking the straight and narrow now. He seems to have gotten his life in check, doing well for himself. TNA, it took a long time for them to put their trust and faith in him, but I guess he earned it, and that, coupled with the fact that they really wanted to make him happy, his contract is coming up soon for renewal, they want to do everything in their power to keep him from leaving and going to WWE, and for those reasons, they put the World Championship on him. He still sells the most merchandise of anybody in the company, not quite the draw he used to be, the live event draw. I think he lost some of that luster at his time off, but Jeff has turned a new leaf, and he is the world champion again. And lastly, Aces and Eights has terrorized Impact Wrestling this year, and fans as well. Terrorized me and a lot of other people just by watching them. I can see that Impact, you know, the folks that run Impact Wrestling had high hopes for this Aces and Eights thing, and they thought it was going to be the second coming of the New World Order, which basically, it's just an invasion angle. We've seen so many invasion angles in wrestling over the years, in every promotion in the world, in the U.S., in Japan, in Mexico. I mean, hell, the idea for the original NWO was essentially stolen by Eric Bischoff from something he saw in New Japan Pro Wrestling in the mid-90s. So wrestling companies have been trying, invasion angles for as long as anybody can remember. And here's this renegade group coming in. They haven't explained exactly what their motives are, other than they want total destruction of TNA. Okay, fine. But it's a bunch of guys in masks. They've unmasked two people so far. D-Von and Doc, the former Luke Gallows. We know that some other people under the masks are Wes Briscoe and possibly Garrett Bischoff and Mike Knox of WWE fame. D'Lo Brown, probably under a mask. Maybe Bully Ray has something to do with them. I mean, 2013 will be the year we obviously find out more about Aces and Eights. And Aces and Eights at some point will probably come to an end. I have not been a fan of Aces and Eights. I think it's just way too unbelievable for me. I think it's way too anticlimactic for me. I think it's hard for me to get behind a bunch of guys in masks when I don't know who they are and I don't know what their motives are. And I'm supposed to think that, you know, everybody's afraid of them and it's total chaos and pandemonium. Well, why were these guys even given the ability to win a match at Bound for Glory so that they can have permission to come to the Impact Zone every week? Why would you allow these guys to do that when they're going around with hammers taking out members of your roster and physically decimating people with foreign objects? Why would you allow something like that? But I keep coming back to this whole thing about what is their motive? What is their purpose in life? What is their mission? What do they expect to accomplish? Why do they want the destruction of TNA? If TNA goes away, what are they going to do? So, for all my issues with Aces and Eights, I know why they did it. And at first it was kind of interesting, and it quickly fizzled out as far as I'm concerned. And the quicker they put this thing to bed, the better. Aces and Eights, the last couple of months, has been the big story in TNA. And now it's not the big story. It's actually only the second or third story going on in TNA. Let's give out some awards here. Superstar of the Year. I'm actually going to give Superstar of the Year and Breakout Star of the Year to the same person because I think he's earned it, and that would be Austin Aries. Austin Aries, again, I talked about him before. Nobody expected him. I don't think at least the people who work in Impact Wrestling didn't expect him to get over and break out the way that he did with the audience, but he did. And he was world champion for a couple of months there. Even now, he's not the champion, but he's probably the top heel in the entire company. He's in the main event on TV each week, usually. He's become their MVP performer. He is their Superstar of the Year and the Breakout Star of the Year. Match of the Year, from the matches I've seen, I have not seen every single TNA pay-per-view. And like I said, I missed the first 4 or 5 months of the year. I wasn't paying any attention until May. But for me, Match of the Year, hard to top the Kurt Angle AJ Styles tag match against Bad Influence at Slammiversary. It was Daniels and Kazarian for the tag titles against Angle and Styles. That was an awesome tag team match. As good of a tag team match as you'll ever see. That would be my match of the year. Second would probably be the Austin Aries-Bobby Roode match at Destination X with that great finish. Austin Aries and Samoa Joe also had a match I think people should check out if they missed it at Slammiversary. They opened the show. I think it was an X Division Championship match. It harkened back to some of the Aries-Joe brawls that took place in Ring of Honor. It was a very hard-hitting match, a very good wrestling match. Well worth going out of your way to see, I think. And also, Bobby Roode and James Storm in that street fight they had, the no-holds-barred match at Bound for Glory. A very bloody match. So if you're not into that, maybe it's not the match for you. But I thought it was very good. It was a very good brawl, more than a match. So those would be my matches of the year in TNA. Flop of the year, Claire Lynch. I was going to say Aces and Eights, but I'm willing to let it play itself out. Claire Lynch was just a debacle in every sense of the word, so realistically, Aces and Eights doesn't even come close. Claire Lynch is clearly the flop of the year in TNA. And as far as Guilty Pleasure of the Year, no surprise here, Joe Park. I love the Joe Park character. I just love it. I love everything he's in. I love everything he does. I find him funny. I find him charming. Everything the character is supposed to be, I totally buy into it. I'm a mark for it. I love it. I don't know if this will last. Again, I fell out of favor pretty quickly with the Funkasaurus, but a lot of that has to do with how he was booked. Again, I think if Brodus Clay was booked the way that I think he should have been, I'd probably still be a big fan of his character. And Joe Park, they're doing everything right, you know? They're doing the slow build. It's obviously building to something. And they haven't blown their, you know, they didn't blow their load in one shot, and they're handling the character perfectly, and hopefully they continue to do so. He is my TNA guilty pleasure of the year. So before we end here, I figured I would do something a little bit different this year I've not done before. I would have some quick predictions for 2013 for both WWE and TNA, some prognosticating, if you will, and just a couple of thoughts. We'll start with TNA here. I think that Jeff Hardy is going to re-sign with TNA in 2013. I get a lot of questions about this, whether Jeff is going to go back to WWE. Is he going to reform the Hardy Boys with Matt? Look, he could go back to WWE, but I'm not feeling it. I really think he's going to stay with TNA. I think he's happy there. I think that TNA is willing to work more with him if he's got, you know, music projects and stuff like that, which he does. They put the title on him, obviously, largely to make him happy. You know, it's true, in TNA he can only go so far. He could probably make a lot more money in WWE, but I don't know that he wants to go back and wrestle a full-time schedule. I just don't get that impression. And I know when he left, he wasn't very happy with the way they treated him there and kind of mocking him for all the drug stuff. He hasn't forgotten about that. So I think Jeff Hardy will re-sign. He will stay with TNA. I also feel that Bully Ray is going to be revealed as a member or in cahoots in some way, shape, or form with Aces and Eights. And at some point in 2013, I believe that Bully Ray will win his first TNA championship. This will be, I believe, his first world championship really anywhere. I think he deserves it. I think he has grown to become a tremendous singles performer. And I do believe that he can be babyface or heel, but more so a heel. I think he's a natural heel. I think he will be a world champion at some point in 2013. And lastly, I think that this will be Hulk Hogan's final year in TNA. I don't know when he'll leave. Probably won't be until later in the year. But I do believe that this will be his last year in the company. And it would not shock me at all. In fact, I almost expect him to wrestle his final match at WrestleMania 30 in 2014. There's rumors that WrestleMania 30 is going to be from the Superdome in New Orleans. We'll find out very soon because usually in the early part of the year they announce the WrestleMania location for the following year. But I could see Hogan leaving TNA wanting one last run. Not even a run, really. Just one last storyline. One last big appearance. One last match in WWE. On the grandest stage of them all. I think, you know, he sees Ric Flair coming back to WWE and probably says, "Why, if he can do it, why can't I do it?" But I do think that this is it for him in TNA. And that I do think he'll be at WrestleMania 30. That's my prediction for Hulk Hogan. So those are my TNA predictions. I have more as far as WWE is concerned. Here are my WWE predictions for 2013. First of all, I don't think Raw is sustainable at 3 hours long. I don't like Raw being 3 hours. I don't think many people do. I think the show is a lot easier to stomach and tolerate at 2 hours. I think it's killing them, quite frankly. And whether it's their call or USA's call, they have to put an end to this. And I do believe that they will come to their senses, either them or USA, whoever it is. And at some point in 2013, I believe probably not until the second half of the year, sometime after WrestleMania for sure. But I do believe that Raw is going to return back to 2 hours at some point in 2013. That is my prediction. I also think that we are finally going to get a new WWE Championship belt design. This is not so too much of a stretch, really. I mean, we've seen the photos. Clearly, they have made or are making a new belt. It's just a matter of when they're going to actually debut it, unless Vince has changed his mind and said, fuck it, I don't like this belt, so we're going to keep what we have. I have said on my show before the perfect time to do it, and maybe this is what they're waiting for. I have not heard. But they have the 50th anniversary of the WWE Championship coming up in April. In fact, Monday, April 29th is the exact day of the 50th anniversary of the championship. And as I've said before, they could do something where, you know, the night after WrestleMania, perhaps, whoever the champion is, comes out with a new belt. Or they could even do a deal where, you know, if the title were vacant, even if the title wasn't vacant, I mean, they could wait, if they wanted to, until the 29th, which is a Monday night. So on Raw, the champion comes out, or if the title is vacant for some reason, a new champion is crowned, and the new title belt is unveiled. But I do think we're finally going to get rid of the spinner that doesn't spin anymore. And we'll get a new WWE Championship, I think, likely for the 50th anniversary, so probably in the next few months. I also predict that Dolph Ziggler will finally cash in his Money in the Bank briefcase at WrestleMania and he will become the new World Heavyweight Champion. And I also predict that Dolph is going to go babyface at some point during the year. We've heard the Big Show in a radio interview talk about how he and a lot of the other veterans on the roster have been trying to convince Dolph to adopt Shawn Michaels' superkick as his new finish. And lo and behold, we have seen Dolph Ziggler utilizing the superkick as a finish, which I think is actually a much better finish than the zigzag. And so he's already doing that. But Big Show also said that they feel that he's going to get over big with that move as a babyface, not so much as a heel. If anything, the move may turn him babyface. And I think people are seeing Dolph for what he is, a very talented performer. He's getting cheers, not in front of every crowd. It depends what city he's in. But there are a lot of Dolph Ziggler fans out there. He's well on his way. So, again, I predict he will finally cash in Money in the Bank at WrestleMania. I have said that perhaps, you know, to make... I can understand them, him being a heel. They don't want to necessarily have him come off as being tough and courageous, so they'll have him cash in, you know, at the last minute when the champion's been beaten down. They could do that. They can make it a surprise, do something that people would least expect. I mean, I've heard the scenario floated around where, you know, Rock wins the championship, goes to WrestleMania, defends against John Cena, beats John Cena for a second time, which will shock people because I'm sure everybody expects Cena to win that, and then Dolph comes out and cashes in. The only problem with that is I don't see Rock beating Cena twice, number one, and number two, they've now made it very clear in the announcing. And they didn't have to do this. They could be very vague and very ambiguous, but like at TLC, for example, Justin Roberts in his announcement, they made it very clear this Money in the Bank contract is not for the WWE Championship. It's for the World Heavyweight title. So I don't think that would work. But whether it's a last-minute surprise, if Dolph announces in advance that he wants to cash in, again, I've heard Sheamus and Randy Orton, with Orton as a heel, bandied about as a possible world title match for WrestleMania, whatever the case may be, I predict Ziggler cashes in, he wins the championship, and finally, and at some point in 2013, he officially goes babyface. Speaking of WrestleMania, I think Ryback will get his WrestleMania moment against The Big Show. And I just pray, if he does, that he can get Big Show up for the Shell Shock without dropping him. I think that's the moment they want to go for there, is the sight of Ryback getting Big Show up on his shoulders, marching around the ring with him and dropping him. And that would be a great moment, absolutely, but I don't know that I have the confidence that he could pull that off. But I do think that will be the match for Ryback at WrestleMania this year. I also think that at some point in 2013, probably sooner rather than later, Ric Flair will become the new Raw General Manager. I don't think Vicky Guerrero in her current role as the Managing Supervisor is going to be in that role for very long, so I could easily see Flair becoming the GM at some point soon. I also think that Roman Reigns will split from the Shield. He will be the first person to kind of break out from the group, which is not to take away from Rollins and Ambrose. I think it's a given that if they could stay healthy, those guys are going to be big stars no matter what. Both can, you know, be world champions at some point. But Roman Reigns, I've compared him in his role currently in the Shield to what Batista had when he was in Evolution. A lot of people didn't think that he would be the first to break out the way he was. They were pushing Randy Orton, but Batista got over. And Batista broke out, and Batista became the world champion, and I could see Roman Reigns following that same path. So I think he'll be the first person to split from the Shield at some point when they're, get tired of them. And he'll be the group's first big breakout star. Not the only breakout star, but the first one. So he'll be somebody to watch out for. The Divas Division. This might get people talking here. I have a bit of a prediction for the Divas Division. The Divas Division in 2013, I believe, is going to be disbanded. And I believe not that they will fire the women, get rid of the women. I think they're just going to use them in different roles. There may be a few women who aren't happy with it, who want to leave the company, who want to wrestle. Perhaps some will go to TNA. But I believe the days of the Divas Division are numbered. I think, you know, one of our listeners asked me if I had heard of this WWE Fan Council that they now have. And I have heard about it. In fact, somebody who listens to this show who wishes to remain anonymous for fear that WWE may revoke his membership for said fan council, I guess, he sent me some screen caps several weeks ago of a survey that they conducted about the WWE Divas. They were asking fans what roles they would prefer to see the women in. Do they want to see them in the ring? Do they want to see them as a manager, special referee, general manager, love interest? Yeah, love interest. Anyway, they also wanted to know if you would prefer to see the Divas on reality TV shows, scripted TV shows like sitcoms, which I thought they already were on. It's called Raw. Or shows like Extra, Access Hollywood. I mean, it's good that they're soliciting feedback from the fans, but I don't give a shit if Layla appears on Entertainment Tonight. I mean, really, I don't care. But the point is, I thought it was very telling that they would be conducting a survey like this and asking the fans if they would prefer to see the women in roles other than wrestlers. Now, maybe the fans voted overwhelmingly for in-ring competitor. They want to see the women wrestle. Maybe they're hungry for women's wrestling. I don't get the sense that that's the case. I think WWE has effectively done a good job of killing women's wrestling. You know, they could have taken TNA's lead from several years ago with how they built up their knockouts division and really made the Divas division something special. You know, brought in some legitimate talent. You know, they got Sara Del Rey now under contract, with that name, no less. But she's working as a trainer in developmental. She's not coming up to the main roster anytime soon as an in-ring competitor. And I'm sure she's a tremendous trainer. I'm not saying that's a bad role for her. But it's just funny to me, they bring in somebody with her talent that a lot of people have been saying for years she should be signed by WWE, and it took them this long, and now they have her, and they have her in a role other than in-ring wrestler. Again, I think that's very telling. You know, we joke every week about how little time is devoted to the Divas matches on Raw. I mean, hell, I created a gimmick called the Divas Stopwatch for that very reason. The only reason they even have a Divas division, they only have matches on TV for them, is clearly because they feel they have to, not because they want to. We've seen more Divas leaving the company on their own terms than at any other point in the company's history. Gail Kim, the Bellas, Maxine, Beth Phoenix, Kelly Kelly. They got rid of Karma. To me, the writing is on the wall. This survey is the icing on the cake. I think the Divas division is living on borrowed time. And 2013 is the year it meets its maker. And like I said, that doesn't mean they're firing all the women. Not at all. But the Divas division as we know it and the Divas title, it's done. I also predict, lastly, more NXT guys will be called up. I know that's a big prediction, but hold your horses. I've got more than just that. There's three names to watch out for, I think, in 2013. One of them is Cassius Ohno, the former Chris Hero. No big surprise there. He's very talented. I think he should already be on the main roster, but he's not. But I think he will be in 2013. Bray Wyatt is the other name to watch out for. He's the former Husky Harris, who I may be most excited about with his current character. I'm very much looking forward to seeing him on TV. And the third guy is Corey Graves, the former Sterling James Keenan on the independent scene. He's a bit on the small side. Not small in terms of height. He's very skinny. I could see that being a problem for him. Supposedly, that's what's holding back Chris Hero from being called up as well. They want him to, you know, work on his physique, add some bulk. But this dude, Corey Graves, he's got a good look. He really reminds me of Jeff Hardy, like, a lot. I don't know. I don't know if it's the tattoos, if it's the, I don't know, his look, his appearance. He reminds me of Jeff Hardy. And if WWE doesn't re-sign Hardy, which I don't think they will, I mean, they would if they had the chance to, but I think he's going to stay in TNA. If they don't re-sign Jeff Hardy, I think that works to Corey Graves' advantage. The fact that I can't be the only one who thinks he bears a resemblance to some degree to Jeff Hardy. But from what I've seen of him in terms of look, some of the matches I've seen on YouTube, because I don't watch NXT regularly, I think he's the third guy. He's the third guy to watch out for. If I had to pick three for 2013, those would be my three. Cassius Ohno, Bray Wyatt, and Corey Graves are going to be the three names to watch out for next year. So there you go. Those are my predictions for WWE and TNA in 2013. I guess it'll be fun a year from now to see how badly I botched it. But there you go. If you have any questions, comments, or suggestions, you can email me at thesolemonster@gmail.com for mailbag questions. We won't have a mailbag on this show, but we have one every week. If you have your own predictions, by the way, Thoughts on 2012 or your predictions for WWE or TNA in 2013? I may share them next week on the Sound Off. Write them. Write them down. Send them to me. TheSolemnMonster@gmail.com. You can follow me on Twitter @SolemnMonster, Facebook.com/TheSolemnMonster. And you can also subscribe to this show in iTunes. It is free. There's a new show every week. There's two of them this week, actually. This is show number two in 2 days I'm doing. And you can subscribe there. Anytime a new episode goes up, boom, it'll automatically be downloaded for you. You don't have to do anything. So there you go. If this is your first time listening to The Sound Off, I appreciate it. Hopefully you enjoyed what you heard. Normally the shows are not this long. This was a special edition of The Sound Off, year-end edition with the year-in-review predictions. And I want to wish everybody, as I did on the last show I just did, I want to wish everybody a happy new year, a safe new year. We'll see you right back here next weekend for the first Sound Off of 2013, episode 254. So until then, be well, stay safe, have a happy new year. We'll see you right back here next week.
Let me tell you something, fella.
This is Joel from Northern Ireland.
Hi, I'm AJ Grimaldo.
And quite simply, the fastest 60 minutes on the internet.
The Solar Monster Sounds Off on SEScoops.com.